And another big, big welcome to our weekly radio magazine, Why So Weekend. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Coming up in today's program, you'll hear from a few of the latest inductees into the Dayton Regional Walk of Fame, including actress Allison Janney. Later in the program, Jonathan McNeil with the Neon in downtown Dayton is back in studio to tell us all about this year's Dayton LGBT Film Festival. Up first, a story from another one of our newest Community Voices producers. In the highly structured lives of working parents, carving out unstructured playtime for young children can be difficult. Community Voices producer Tess Cortez explored how other parents and caregivers over the age of 35 navigate this path.
Embarking on the journey of parenthood later in life has had its challenges among the rewards. One challenge has been socializing my young son. He doesn't have siblings, and most of my friends have older or no kids. Enter the world of play dating. I sat down with mom of two, Marianne Kirk, and caregiver Amanda Englert to discuss this once unknown but now pervasively familiar subject.
Somewhat like a date. You arrange a time, you arrange a place, you show up with the kids, and they play.
There's often even, you know, a certain activity that will be planned. We're making muffins or we're playing dominoes. And I think it's also a chance for stay-at-home parents to interact with adults.
Yeah, the parents. You know, it's obviously really important for the kids to get along and actually want to play with each other. So the kids have to click. But also, because there's the adult interaction, you're really hoping that you're going to hit it off with the parents because you'll be spending 1 to 4 hours with them while your kids play. Pretty unbearable sometimes if you just don't hit it off with the parents.
I also think there's a direct correlation to the more parents who are in the room, the less attention's actually being paid to the kid. So some of the play dates where ostensibly the ratio was 1 to 1 is when a kid ends up in the ER because the parents are having their own conversation and someone is climbing up a bookshelf. You learn a lot about humans anthropologically watching playdates. Because adults are still developing, too.
While my son was in daycare, we met Chris and Olga Schrock. Our sons were friends in class, so we started arranging playdates.
Well, we don't have any family in the area, so we actually spend a lot of time seeking out friends for our son. We latch on to who he likes and who he talks about, but we also look around the room and see what kind of people we might want to be friends with.
I would say that there's been a couple of occasions where I've had to tell my wife that she's too eager. She would, right off the bat, say, oh, here's my phone number. We live over here. Can you give us a call? We'll do a play date. And I always tell her, you can't ask for the digits on the first date. Got to play it cool.
I began wondering about using current tools of the dating game to meet other parents. I mean, it's 2017, there's an app for that, right? So I signed up for the playdate app Peanut and began looking at the profiles of mothers in my area, and then beyond. None were over the age of 34.
So did you guys know that out there in the world, like, it's a thing to have apps for playdating? Have you guys heard of that? Or
no.
Have you ever used anything like that?
No. My son's friend, I think that they did tell us about, like, meetups, but we had no idea what that was.
Would you use one?
I'm more old school. I don't think it's a great idea. Maybe I'm not as eager as Olga is in the play dating realm.
It actually sounds like too much technology for me. I think I'd have to go the old school way, like Chris is saying.
You guys both work full-time jobs and you have two small children. How do you make time for finding parents to play date?
My son plays baseball and other sports, and we've made some really good friends through that interaction and getting to know the parents there. As far as technology goes and finding people on social media and things like that, we have some pretty interesting stories about finding babysitters.
There's playdates that you design to play, and then there are these co-op situations where you do make a commitment to a certain families and you sort of function as caregivers for each other's children and just sort of a larger extended family. And that is a very, very beautiful thing that's worth all the dating.
So my journey to find parents of a certain age with young kids continues. The old school way. I just signed my son up for soccer. For WYSO Community Voices, this is Tess Cortez.
Tess Cortez is a graduate of WISO's 2017 Community Voices class. To learn more about training opportunities, visit our website, wiso.org. Since 1996, more than 160 influential people with ties to the Miami Valley have been inducted into the Dayton Regional Walk of Fame. On Thursday, seven more people were honored with a spot on the walk. The honorees enshrined this year include actress and Oakwood native Allison Janney. We sat down with the popular West Wing and Mom sitcom star just before the induction ceremony at Sinclair College. In this interview, she told us what the honor means not only for her, but for her parents.
Well, I pretty much grew up here in Dayton, although I was not born here. I feel like I am from Ohio because this is where I grew up. This is where I started my education at the Miami Valley School here in Dayton, Ohio, where I got introduced to the arts and discovered my passion for making a fool of myself in front of people and where my first I chased my first dreams, you know, trying to be an ice skater back in the day when my father owned an ice skating rink, and I used to just spend every minute on the ice. And yeah, it all started here for me. All roads lead back to Dayton, Ohio for me.
Daytonians have a big appreciation for the arts. Was it easy for you to take that avenue?
You know, my mother, who is I consider her, and a lot of people do, a great doyen of Dayton, Ohio. She's always been involved in the arts, and she used to be an actress when she was younger, and she was roommates with Eileen Brennan and Rue McClanahan at a certain point in her life. And so I knew that was in her life, so my imagination started going wild with thinking, what if I did that too. So I think I naturally went into the arts because of my mother's past interest and her commitment to the arts in Dayton. And I know I'm going to jump over a little bit, but she's always been so connected here in Dayton with the Muse Machine, that wonderful organization that Susie Bassani started and that does so much for arts and education in Ohio. And she's an amazing woman, and she very much influenced my direction in life.
You lent your voice to Muse Machine several years ago for their production of Into the Woods.
Right.
And as someone sitting in the audience, that was a pretty thrilling moment.
Did you know it was me, or it was in the program, so you saw it was going to be me?
Well, I had interviewed the cast also,
Oh, so yes.
But that was pretty great.
It was pretty cool. I got to do that. I love part of the beauty of voiceovers. I can be anywhere in the world and do that, so it was an easy favor to give, and Susie's a sort of hard to say no to.
The Walk of Fame, not quite an Emmy, which you have won several, but tell me your feelings about what's taking place here today.
It's a little overwhelming. I'm always a little shy and a little modest when it comes to my accomplishments and how much what I deserve to be honored for. I'm a little shy about it, but it's very cool. My mom and dad and I walked down to 3rd Street in Williams and saw where my little stone will be, and it was really exciting. I got chills and felt very proud to be part of the fabric of Dayton, Ohio, and I think my parents are really proud, and that makes me incredibly happy.
Well, I know that we here in Dayton are proud that we can claim you as part of our community. So good luck today, and thanks for joining us.
I am so happy to be here. Thank you. Thanks.
Oscar and Marjorie Boonshoft were also honored for their many charitable contributions to the Dayton area. They're both deceased, but the Boonshoft son, David, told us that much of the money they donated came from his father's success as a commodities trader.
In many ways, they had very ordinary lives. My father was trained as an engineer at Stevens Tech in New Jersey and came to the Dayton area to work at Wright-Patterson right before World War II. And we lived in Dayton View, regular house, regular upbringing. And at some point, he decided to, play the stock market. And if you've ever known an engineer, they're very special in the way they look at numbers and events. They can do things kind of unemotionally. They can look at evidence. If you can't measure it, it doesn't exist to an engineer. And he applied that skill with numbers to trading commodities and did very well. And I think that his personal morals and his ethics was that he felt he had enough as a middle-class individual and that there was a lot of need around him. And it was the community that he could see, and that's why he really wanted to give the money to different projects in Dayton. And it's not like he was unspecific. He was very specific. He believed in education, specifically science education, medicine, social welfare. And these are the things he really wanted to help support. And many of these programs, people will tell you, he was absolutely involved in what they were doing with the money and how they were spending it. So he spent really the last 30 years of his life as a commodities trader, you know, giving the money to the city of Dayton in different venues as he went along.
So his fortune in the markets was not something that he took lightly and just considered personal good fortune. He needed to give back to the community where he lived.
Well, he felt he had a special talent for doing this because he always warned me never to try this. And you know, I probably would have been too emotional, you know, and, oh, my God, this is going up, this is going down. But the way he applied it and the way he approached it, but that was the exciting part. He felt good about himself. And you know, people of good character, when they do good works, they feel good. They feel fulfilled. They're not empty. So he used to talk about how giving made him, not like he had less when he got done, but he had more. And that's how he fulfilled himself in life.
I guess finally, just tell us what this induction into the Dayton Walk of Fame means for your family today.
Well, it's a little weird, you know, but because these are the kind of things you don't really anticipate. But it's an honor, and you know, I think it's a great story how people can be involved in their community and do what they can, and it's, you know, whatever talents they have, whatever aptitudes they have, they can bring them to bear. They can bring them to bear in their own lives, and they can create a ripple that affects others. And it doesn't have to be a big ripple. It can be a small ripple. But it's always a good thing to do, and I hope it sets an example of how people can live.
Well, thanks for your time today, and I know the Dayton community thanks your parents for all they've done.
Well, it's an honor, and I appreciate it very much, and thanks for having me.
Also honored on Thursday were Brigadier General Benjamin Davis Sr., who was the first African-American to be promoted to the rank of general in the U.S. Armed Forces in 1940, and Kathy Geiswyth, creator of the comic strip Kathy, which ran in newspapers around the world for more than 35 years. Former Ohio State Senator and U.S. Congressman David Hobson, who represented parts of Dayton and Springfield for more than 20 years, and Shawnee Chief Tecumseh were also inducted into this year's Walk of Fame. You can hear all the interviews on our website at WYSO.org. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WYSO Weekend. You're listening to WYSO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. I'm Jerry Kenney. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning and joining me in studio for a rundown of this year's LGBT Film Festival, the 12th annual, in fact, is Jonathan McNeil, manager with the Neon Movies in downtown Dayton.
Hi, Jerry. Thanks for having me.
Oh, sure. Jonathan, so your press release this year asked a question, and I'm going to let you answer it. What do Bette Midler, Danny Glover, Danny DeVito, Laura Linney, and Ian McKellen and Laverne Cox all have in common?
Well, they're all part of films that are playing at this year's festival.
Great. I'm excited. Bette Midler is going to be here.
Well, Bette Midler is not going to be here, unfortunately. She has a gig on Broadway, so she can't make it. But she's in a film actually that's opening night, which is called Freak Show, and she's one of the people in that film. Now, that whole list are not all in Freak Show. Those are different folks from different films, but her and Laverne Cox both have small parts in Freak Show.
So it's a whole weekend of films, and this event grows every year.
That's right. We've seen nice growth every year, fewer and fewer empty seats throughout the weekend, and it's just really great community support from businesses and people to help make it happen.
Well, let's state right up front that the all-weekend passes went fairly quickly this time around, but tickets are available for all films.
Yes, we do at this point still have single tickets available for all the shows, and some of them will go quickly, though. Press really hasn't hit yet for the festival. It's really only been kind of past attendees that know about the festival, and if maybe you saw a flyer around town or something. But otherwise, opening night will go and be a full house regardless, because that $8 gets you a movie that is fresh off of premiere in L.A. earlier this summer. And then it's directed by Trudy Styler, you know, married to Sting. She's a great director who adapted this young adult novel called Freak Show. And then you get into the opening night party, and that gets you a complimentary cocktail and appetizer. So
let's talk a little bit about the premise of Freak Show and then talk about the other films.
Freak Show is about a boy in a high school who's having trouble fitting in, but really doesn't want to fit in necessarily, wants to be his own person, and decides to run for homecoming queen.
And then you've got a little bit later start on Saturday at 12:30 with Top Drawer Shorts, which is kind of a fan favorite.
Yes. People didn't really know what to make of them initially, like what's a collection of shorts, but it has grown and is now usually a sold out screening as well. So we just look at, over 70, 80 short films and come up with a collection of what we think are the best. And this year there are, I believe, 7 shorts that play in that section.
And international films as well.
All over the map. Yep. So comedies, drama, documentary, international, all things that are just short subject matter and make a nice hour and a half piece.
And Danny DeVito appears in one of the shorts, Curmudgeon?
He does, actually. Curmudgeon's was a play initially written by Joshua Conkle, and we're actually bringing Joshua in as one of the guests for the festival. He wrote the play. The play was in New York, and Danny DeVito's daughter saw it, if I remember correctly, and she wanted her father to be involved in an adaptation, and Danny DeVito ended up directing and starring in the film, actually.
Following the shorts, you've got something that I'm pretty excited about, The Untold Tales of Amistad Maupin.
So this is a documentary about Amistad, and this is actually one of the highest rated films from the committee this year. People on the committee really loved it. It got nearly perfect scores from everyone on the committee. It's a film about his life and his military background and his living in San Francisco and writing these books that became very beloved and then adapted into film. So Laura Linney is in it. Of course, she was in the adaptation of the Tales of the City, and Ian McKellen and some other recognizable faces too.
You mentioned that the films are put together by a committee. Let's talk briefly about that process.
Sure. So there are several people on the committee. We try to make a nice, well-rounded group of diverse folks in the community who want to invest or are willing to invest a couple hundred hours over the summer to look at all these films and curate what we think is the strongest lineup available.
You've got two other selections to round out Saturday, Sensitivity Training, which was a popular pick by the committee.
Yes, this is one that the committee loved. It's a comedy. It's really, really fun, about a woman who works in a lab and is really uptight and really kind of terse with her employees. And they determine that she needs some sensitivity training. And the woman who is her, who comes in to counsel her, we found out after we booked the film that she grew up and graduated from Beaver Creek High School. So we're flying her in as one of the guests as well, Jill Alexander. And she's very funny in this film. And she actually has quite a resume. She was on several episodes of Mad Men. She's on the TV show Silicon Valley. So very great, gifted comedic actress.
Great. And we'll round out Saturday night with Alaska is a Dragon, is the premise right there in the title?
It is. So it's about a guy that works at a fishery in Alaska and does drag on the side and is certainly bullied at work. And we're flying in the director of that film as well. So she's L.A. based now, but did work for some time in a fishery in Alaska. And interestingly, of the 7 feature films we have this year, 5 of them are directed by women, which is a really great ratio in today's climate of filmmaking.
Well, great. And audiences really take to guests who come in to speak who have been involved in these films.
That's right. It gives audiences an opportunity to engage with directors and talent associated with the films and really kind of make it more personal and more kind of understanding of both the process and of the climate of what it's like to make films with LGBT content.
And I'm always impressed with the questions from the audience. The Dayton community is pretty in tune with the issues that are being addressed in some of these
films.
That's
right. Pretty savvy audiences generally. Yep.
Let's talk about Sunday. We're going to start off at 1 o'clock in the afternoon with Pushing Dead. Tell us about that.
Pushing Dead. It's hard to say that it's an HIV comedy, but it is. It's about a man who is dealing with the cost of medical expenses associated with his HIV. He accidentally puts a check from his mother that was a $100 birthday check into his savings account and is thus deemed making too much money to be receiving the medical services that he's receiving. It's touching, but it's also very timely and topical about talking about insurance and health benefits, things like that. Danny Glover actually plays a friend of his in the film and is really pretty terrific.
What else do we have on Sunday?
Sunday, then we go on to Rebels on Point, which is a tremendous documentary about the Trocadero Ballet Troupe, which is the drag ballet, which these really incredibly gifted dancers who do kind of traditional ballet, but with a bit of a middle finger, extended, because they're on point. We never see male ballet dancers in point shoes and doing the work that we traditionally associate with ballerinas.
And to wrap up on Sunday, it's God's Own Country, a film from the UK.
That's right. IndieWire actually called this film the UK's Brokeback Mountain, but better. And it really is a lovely, gorgeous, hopeful, romantic film.
If you have to sum up this year's LGBT Film Festival, as far as selection, variety, diversity, how would you do that?
We have a little something for everybody. There's a lot of films directed by women, but not a whole lot of female content. More Sensitivity Training, which is our centerpiece film on Saturday, is about women. But there hasn't been a lot of female content out there for us to look at and feel like really rose to the surface. So it's a tough place to be in. We wish there was more, but we really want to put quality and diversity in the same mix. You know, I think it's interesting that almost every year people ask me, whether it's press or whether it's community members or just patrons at the Neon, wonder why there is still a need for an LGBT film festival. And they ask, there's so much representation and narrative plot points on television and in movies about LGBT characters. Why is there a need? And I think it's very interesting this year that I have not been asked that question one time by anyone. And I think that the LGBT community certainly seems to be under more of an attack in the last year than in the past several years. We made a lot of progress, but now we're taking some hits again. And I feel like the community knows that it is important for us to have a voice and to create community and to continue to educate.
The Neon has a rich tradition of bringing independent films to Dayton audiences. This LGBT Film Festival begins Friday night, October 13th, and runs through Sunday the 15th. Jonathan, where can we get additional details?
You can go to DaytonLGBT.com, and all the information is there, a link for tickets, some trailers to watch, synopsis of each film, all that stuff. So, and a thanks to all of our sponsors.
Jonathan McNeil with Neon Movies. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Ohio's opioid crisis continues to escalate. In an effort to curb the epidemic, the state is launching a new program to help spot criminal activity and prescription drug abuse. Since 2006, Ohio's been collecting information on all prescriptions for controlled substances, those prescribed by doctors and dispensed by pharmacies. The data is tracked in the so-called automated RX reporting system, also known as ORS. Now, with the help of a nearly $400,000 federal grant, State Pharmacy Board experts will begin analyzing ORS prescription drug data. Pharmacy Board Policy Director Cameron McNamee says the goal is to identify patterns of criminal activity and prevent addicts from ending up in the criminal justice system.
The pre-criminal intervention program is a program where we will utilize data that's collected by the Ohio Automated RX reporting system, which is a system that collects all prescriptions dispensed to Ohio patients. And what we'll do is we'll utilize that data to look for individuals who may be engaged in what we call doctor shopping. So these are people that go see multiple providers, prescribers who try and obtain drugs. And what we're trying to do is look for signs of abuse and addiction. And what the pre-criminal intervention program will do is, or the funding will allow us to do, is hire two specific agents to identify these individuals and then work with local law enforcement and treatment providers to intervene. And the hope there is that they're intervening before they start down the path where they are using illicit and very potent substances such as heroin or fentanyl.
And so what manner would they be contacted with? A general letter of notice, or would they be directly contacted?
So the program is actually based off of a successful program operated by the Nevada State Board of Pharmacy. And initially it would start off with a letter contacting them, explaining to them after an investigation what they're doing, overutilization of the system, or aka doctor shopping, is a crime. And that they would like to speak with them to discuss options for either making them see one prescriber, one pharmacist, and have them sign an agreement to only utilize, you know, one prescriber and one pharmacy for their healthcare needs, or to talk to them further and connect them with a treatment provider, such as the local Adams boards that have treatment providers available in their community to connect them with.
You mentioned the successful Nevada program this is based on. How have they been able to quantify their success? Are they seeing lower numbers in any way?
They monitor the individual who is going to or has agreed to only go to one prescriber and one pharmacy to obtain their controlled substances. And they've monitored those individuals. They monitor them actually for a year out after they sign the agreement. And they've shown that they have very, very high rates of compliance, meaning that they have reduced their doctor shopping behavior. The other is they've been able to follow through with individuals and successfully get them entered into treatment. And that's another metric we'll be using to evaluate this program.
Let me just ask about the OARS system, the Ohio Automated RX Reporting System, in which the state began collecting information on all prescriptions for controlled substances that were prescribed by doctors and dispensed by pharmacies. That began in 2006. Was there any challenge or blowback from that?
Back in 2006, we had a lot of support and from actually some of the pharmaceutical companies to help get this program up and running. We have had a tremendous amount of support from the governor, the legislature, about expanding it, about expanding access to it. So allowing, for instance, in this budget, we expanded access to drug courts to have access to it, coroners to have access to it, hospital peer review committees, so the hospitals can review the prescribing of their fellow doctors as part of a peer review committee and try and intervene to educate them about better prescribing practices. It's been a very positive experience with a lot of the decision makers. And the doctors, frankly, like it. I mean, the doctors, they only know what they know. And in this fragmented healthcare system that we find ourselves in, you know, if you leave the Mercy Health healthcare system, the doctor, the records stop there. And so they don't know who they're seeing to obtain other drugs. So it's not only an abuse detection system, but it's also the only system that collects every drug that they're getting, every controlled substance drug that they're getting. So it's also a clinical tool that the doctors really respond positively to.
That all makes sense. And can you talk about how soon the funding rolls out and when the training begins? Is it already underway? And when does all this take place?
The grant actually starts October 1. We'll be hiring new agents with obviously looking for specialized skills dealing with addicted populations. And so we feel like we're probably going to hopefully get up and running by sometime in November to begin this program. But it certainly will, it'll take a little bit of time to get the agents hired and trained to begin to do this program.
Cameron McNamee, thanks for speaking with us, and thanks for the information this afternoon.
Thanks for having me.
Ohio Pharmacy Board Policy Director Cameron McNamee. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world. I'm Jerry Kenney. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10. Thanks again for joining us. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.